afternoon insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Hey, welcome to a Monday. Thank you for joining us here on the radio today. We got a lot to talk about. Just a quick rundown. We're having kind of a day off on the impeachment hearings, and boy, I don't want to pummel you with that, but over the weekend, there were some interesting things that were brought up, and one was from our representative, Chris Stewart, our 2nd District Congressman. And he is making the claim that basically any public support for the impeachment is crumbling because of what we're seeing on TV. These open hearings, in other words. I'd really like to find out, in your opinion, if you feel that's true. And you can either make it really personal. Are your feelings for or against, I'll put it that way, the impeachment? Are they modifying? And to use Congressman Stewart's words, is your support, or do you perceive the support? And don't just fall into the default positions, please. You know, what are your real thoughts on this? Not what your Uncle Louie, who reads every conspiratorial page known to mankind, said over the weekend at Sunday dinner. But what are your feelings? Do you feel that there is a case building against the president? Or do you feel, as Congressman Stewart said, that the case is crumbling? We'd love to hear from you on the Utah Community Credit Union KSL text line at 57500. And you can just put it simply, crumbling or not crumbling. And then if you care to add any of your thoughts, and of course you can always just leave us a voice message at 801-575-7668. I just wanted to float that out there, and then we'll also run through what the schedule looks like for this week. Some of the other issues that are on the docket, we'll be joined by the March of Dimes today. It's Prematurity Awareness Month. We had a friend of the family very, very recently, a friend of my son, Ian, and his wife, Tyra. Our baby came just a little early, but nothing serious at all. But this baby, their friends, our family's friends, boy, it came way, way, way early. And sometimes for anybody who's ever been to Primary Children's Hospital and you walk through the newborn intensive care unit, and it's just almost mind-boggling, it's startling, and it's miraculous what they can do to save little tiny, tiny kids' lives now. So we'll talk with Dr. Amy Nussbaum about that. It's American Educators Week. We're going to celebrate by talking with Heidi Matthews, who is the president of the Utah Education Association, what we can all do to show support for our children, especially during for our teachers of our children during this week. Pete Ashdown, I always love talking with Pete. Over the many years now, we've talked with him about some real inside baseball on technologies. We've talked with him about X-Mission. When he was running for the Senate, we talked with Pete about politics. And this time, it's Save the Old Utah Theater. We'll kind of rehearse what the Utah Theater was, what it currently is, and what it would take to save it. That's coming up in just a little while. And I caught this today. Ron Gibson, who is the president of the Utah Farm Bureau Federation, they're having their convention. Now, I know a lot of people are going, oh, okay, the Farm Bureau, I'm sure it's important to farmers, but where does that hit me? Well, listen to what they're talking about this year. They're talking about the hemp production, marijuana, there or derivatives thereof. They're talking about the new tax proposals for the state of Utah and how it will affect agriculture. Agriculture, last I heard, was about 13-14% of Utah's economy, so it's a big issue. And then suicide prevention. That's coming up at the Farm Bureau's annual gathering. So I'm very interested to see what Ron Gibson has to say about all that. That's just a little rundown, a little highlight of what's coming up on the program today. And we're joined by Robin Garfield, who is kind of our Big Kahuna producer, kind of oversees the talk universe in her own special way.
Wow.
Here at K. I'm expanding your horizons.
I'll take that. Does
here.
It come with a pay raise?
No.
All of these?
Ah. No, yeah.
Okay, well, I'll
let's,
take...
Let's not talk about pay raises. Okay.
Well, that's a great segue into the first headline I have. These are all pulled today from KSL.com.
Uh-huh.
Americans take pride in local news,
right,
but are unwilling to pay for it, a new study finds.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, that's the bugaboo, isn't it, for everything, whether it's a blogger, an influencer, whatever it might be, or just good old traditional media. You know, sometimes I'll just see an interesting headline on Utah policy or whatever, and I'll bring it up, and all of a sudden it comes from the Tribune. And it goes, you want to continue this? Pay up.
And you get irritated, but someone's got to pay the lights.
Yeah, and I mean, in the old days, we paid for the Tribune or we paid for the Deseret News, unless we stole it from the barber or from the doctor's office, you know, or we went to McDonald's and read it over our Egg McMuffin. But yeah, we've always paid for this, but usually through subscription. And now, well, this is a subscription, but I know it's tough. It's really tough to get people to pay for things, especially when it's on a glowing screen in front of them. We've always touted, oh, the internet's free. This is free. This is not tax. This is great. And of course, back in the old days, we felt we could buy anything on the internet and pay no taxes, have no consequences. And we're rapidly learning that isn't necessarily the case. So, yeah.
Yeah. CNN Business came out with a study that said there is a market failure in the local news business. And that long term, we've got to come up with a solution because, you know, we don't work for free.
That's right.
Some days,
I do.
It feels like that. Well, yeah, right. Some days it feels like that. But, yeah, it is tricky. And I get irritated when I see these paywalls. But, you know.
I know.
Someone's got to pay the lights, got to pay the salaries. So, all right, moving on to the next one. This is the one I really want to talk about, Doug. This is the headliner of the day. This is also from KSL.com via CNN. And I want to give full credit to the women who wrote this article, Elizabeth Wolf and Melissa Gray. Here's the headline. Taco Bell wants you to take its tacos, stick them in a blender, and serve them as a bisque this Thanksgiving.
Ooh, a taco bisque.
There's a recipe from Taco Bell on how to incorporate tacos and their products into your Thanksgiving feast. And I will tell you, this article, I was dying. The writing on it is so funny.
So funny.
Yeah, so I'll give you a quick. I'm sorry, I'm not going to let you comment on it. I'm going to just keep talking over you. Saute your onions and garlic. Take four rolled chicken tacos. Quarter them because you're not a complete savage. Plop them into your soup mixture, reduce heat, and simmer for 10 minutes. While simmering, you should take a moment to reflect on what you've just done and how it will impact the rest of your life.
You remember the guy that used to do the Bass-O-Matic, and he just put a bass in the blender?
Oh.
And then there are the guys that blend everything, and I'm trying to imagine. It almost seems a little sacrilegious, doesn't it?
Tacos
to take
blender.
A perfectly good taco, you know, that you could put the mild sauce on and just kind of wolf it down in its purity, and then grind it up in the blender.
And cook it. Mm. The very last step, they say, at this point, you will never be able to reverse what you have just done, and now you must garnish it as if everything is fine, and you are fine, and your friends and family are fine.
Uh-huh. Wow, I'll tell you what. I don't know, but compared to yams, that sounds pretty good.
Oh, there's no pleasing you with the yams. Yeah, so go on KSL.com and read this article. It really is. It's from CNN, but it's on this recipe Taco Bell just put out.
Can't you just see Aunt Louise out there going over to Taco Bell, grinding it all up for your Thanksgiving?
Yeah, you have to go buy the tacos at Taco Bell to make the soup. So I will tell you, on the Garfield table, there will be no taco bisque. I hate to say it, this Thanksgiving. I'm adventurous, but...
Taco bisque.
I'm not. Those two words should just not... Okay.
Yeah, somehow this just is not, I don't know, if you put a little gelatin in it, you could turn it into a Jello thing, you know?
Those just,
ooh,
we are violating FCC regulations.
I know,
right now
with obscenity.
We cannot. Jello,
taco obscenity.
This is terrible. Okay, last one here. we're supposed to blow right on past that. Bill Gates has just topped Jeff Bezos as the richest person in the world. I think the number was $110 billion.
Huh.
That Bill is worth now.
You know, whenever you become so wealthy that even if you make it your full-time job to spend the increase and to try to not let it eat into the principal, you know you're really rich.
Yeah.
And holy cow, what do you do in that case? How do you properly dispose of your money? Even if you are the best, nicest, wonderful, philanthropic, you know, angelic, near sainthood type person or deity, how would you do that? How do you even just get rid, assuming that it's making a halfway decent return? Let's just say, I mean, you know, a good mutual fund will return you 9, 11% average over a long period of time. I mean, how do you get rid of $10 billion?
Billion.
Just so you don't continue to increase and kind of embarrass yourself?
Yeah. I mean, Gates has the Gates Foundation, Melinda and Bill Gates, and they do so much work with immunizations and things like that. Yeah, but that's not $110 billion worth of, like you said, philanthropy. Yeah, that is.
Yeah, $10 billion a year you'd have to blow off just so it didn't continue to grow.
That is a lot of servings of Taco Jello there.
A lot of servings. You know, imagine Imagine the number of yams you could buy with that.
to dispose of properly.
To dispose of properly with a shotgun.
As exactly. as a clay yam.
Yeah.
All right, that's all I have for you today.
That's it, huh?
We're talking tacos, local news, and Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates. That's it. That's a wrap.
Wow. I can't imagine that much money. It's beyond my comprehension. Wow. I just looked over. I have 16 new messages.
Oh, you said impeachment.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But we did get a taco. I don't know what that word is, so I'm not going to say it. I'm going to have to look it up first. But something, a taco something, might be very savory.
Hmm.
Oh, it's like Jell-O. Okay, I didn't want to make sure. Our producer, Kellyanne, just whispered in my ear. You know, sometimes I've seen these bizarre words, and, you know, I haven't quite known what they meant, and I've said them on the air, and I shouldn't have, you know, something in a foreign lung. But there you go. A taco aspic might be very savory.
Oh, yes. I've heard that word before. Yeah, it's an old timey.
Am I the only person that didn't know what an aspic
was? I've heard
of
it before. I would have needed some prompting there, too, but I've heard of that, you know.
But the rest of it is all about impeachment stuff. Do you or do you not agree with Representative Chris Stewart, our 2nd District Congressman, that is predicting the impeachment hearings will turn Americans to supporting President Trump? In other words, and the term was used, the support is crumbling. Is it? Inquiring minds want to know. All right, when we come back, we'll run through what the, it's almost like the playbill. The playbill of this week's impeachment proceedings. I know, and then we'll kind of move on to a lot of other things that will really affect you in your daily life. That's coming up here at KSL. Okay, before we do anything else, let's run through the playbill, as it were, for the impeachment hearings. And right today, we're getting a bye, as it were. Listen to me, Utah's Mr. Sports, using sports terminology here. But nothing going on today, either public or private. Tuesday, however, tomorrow, the public hearings in the morning, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander S. Vindman, the top Ukraine expert for the National Security Council, and Jennifer Williams, an aide to Vice President Mike Pence, will testify. In the afternoon, it's Kurt D. Volker, the former United States Special Envoy to Ukraine, and Timothy Morrison, a Europe and Russia expert for the National Security Council. There are no private depositions that are scheduled for Tuesday. A little background quickly. Colonel Vindman and also Mr. Morrison both listened in real time to a July phone call. You might remember that was a big, big deal at first. It seems like when one hurdle is met, well, then it just gets higher. The bar gets higher and higher, or lower and lower, depending on your viewpoint. But do you remember when so many, especially Republicans, were saying that, okay, all this is secondhand. This is a phone call. This is a transcript. It was secondhand information. You show me somebody who had firsthand information on this or was actually in the room, then I'll pay attention. Well, this is the guy. They both listened, they both listened in real time to that July phone call between President Trump and the Ukraine president, and that this is all at the center of the impeachment inquiry. Not only, and then the quid pro quo. That's another thing, too. People have said, well, you know, if anybody with firsthand knowledge ever heard some of these things, all we have heard is secondhand. Well, now we have firsthand. But again, was it an impeachable offense, and was there an actual demand for quid pro quo? I would say it's safe to say it was implied, or it was kind of suggested, or there were kind of the read between the lines type thing. But, you know, who knows? Wednesday, November 20th, what's on the playbill? Public hearings in the morning. Gordon D. Sondland. We heard a lot about him in the testimony last week. The United States ambassador to the European Union. In the afternoon, it will be Laura K. Cooper, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russian, Ukraine, and Eurasian Affairs, and David Hale, who is, a little difference there, David Hale, who is the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. No private depositions are scheduled. A little background on those who will be testifying On Wednesday, you might recall, Mr. Sondland will most likely be the day's most consequential witness. He's been mentioned a lot in previous testimony. He had the direct contact with President Trump and has already informed the committee that he told a top Ukrainian official that the country would probably have to give Mr. Trump a public pledge for investigations before it would receive frozen military aid. But he will be pressed, of course, to confirm another episode that he is said to be involved in. This gets back to the quid pro quo, rather than kind of that friendly suggestion was a demand. You want the frozen money? Pony up. Did that or did that not happen? On Thursday, November 21st, Fiona Hill, this will be in the public hearings, National Security Council's former senior director for Europe and Russia. As the schedule stands, Ms. Hill will be the department's, the Democrats rather, final public witness. And from her vantage point inside the White House, she had literally a front row seat to what she viewed as, this is her, quote, a nightmare situation, which in private interests were, in which the private interests of the president were put above the nation's. She will also provide testimony that John R. Bolton, the president's former national security advisor and her boss, was deeply alarmed as well. I think a lot of people were surprised at Mr. Bolton's rather short tenure. I think many people initially, with as hawkish as he is and as plain-spoken as Mr. Bolton has been for years and years, some of us kind of thought, well, maybe this is a marriage that will last. And boy, it did not. Okay, let's share some of the texts here that we have had come in just the last few moments when I used our Second District Congressman's words from over the weekend. He appeared on some of the Talking Head shows where he said, because of the public things that we, Joe and Jane Average, are seeing here in the United States of America, that our support for the impeachment process was crumbling. So is it? This texter said, if only the truth could prevail, oh no, it's all about gotcha from both sides. That is absolutely true. Every now and then, once in a while, somewhere in the course of the bloviation, you sometimes almost are shocked when you hear a question that's actually thoughtful, that the person asking the question hasn't already stated something and then asked for a mere confirmation, in other words, to bolster his or her or their cases. But every now and then there'll be a question that's open-ended and really seems to be seeking an answer and, heaven forbid, truth. But boy, our texter is right. The bottom line is everybody is there to protect their position, to protect their party, to protect their president, to protect, dare I say, their congressional seat in this case. This person said, it's crumbling like a stale cookie. I'm with the congressman, referring to Congressman Stewart. Crumbling or growing, I don't know. However, the three witnesses I saw testify were sharp, articulate, and believable. You know, I mentioned that last week. Often you would see a split screen where you saw the Congress person who was asking or, you know, going off on their diatribe, and then you saw the other people, you know, Mr. Kent, Mr. Taylor, and others, the former ambassador to Ukraine. You saw her sitting there, and every time I'd look at that and I'd go, who do I trust? And boy, I'll tell you, 9 times out of 10, it fell to those that were being allegedly questioned versus those who were their interrogators. I'm sorry. That I thought, boy, who has the credibility and who seems to have the agenda here? Is it the person asking the question or the person, in many cases, people who have served this country their entire life? Who do you believe? Let's see. What else have we got here? Do we have we have a second or two to read a few more. And we'll share more of these as we continue on. This person said, my support for the impeachment inquiry is not crumbling. We need to get all the facts out to make a decision. If any, my confidence in Congress is continuing to crumble, if it's even possible to decline further. And Representative Stewart blindly supports Trump regardless of what the president does. If I was in his district, I would not vote for him, since he has put party over principle, in my opinion. This person said, the case against the president is crumbling. I've read and listened to both sides, and it has become evident that, as with every investigation since Trump became president, the charges are a fabrication by those attempting to get him out of office. It is a colossal waste of time, money, and energy, all of which should be spent on positive things we need for our country. I agree with that latter part. There are many things that are very positive that we need bipartisan support, we need to get done. But I wouldn't agree that everything is fabrication. I think the only real question here is what we have learned. How high does your eyebrow go up? How concerning is it? Because there are many things. I don't know. I mean, even Congressman Stewart has said every day the president is doing things that surprises him and even some days disappoints him. But have we reached an impeachable level? But, oh, my goodness, I've said this before. This president daily, and I know, go ahead, send me the hate mail on this. The president daily disappoints me. The president daily shocks and embarrasses me. The president daily, I just shake my head at the juvenile responses, the things that any of us would chastise our children for. He does on a regular basis. But that's not impeachable unless it hits certain high water marks or low water marks for an impeachable process. That's the question. That's the question. Has the president done anything impeachable? All right, we'll come back. We've got a lot more in store for you. We are going to talk with Dr. Amy Nussbaum with the March of Dimes and its Prematurity Awareness Month. We'll talk about some of the progress made with our very, very tiny kids.
More afternoon news and in-depth coverage with Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Well, it's good to have you along on the program today. We're going to be all over the place. We've got a lot of things to talk about, and I'm so pleased that Dr. Amy Nussbaum could join us with the March of Dimes. It's Prematurity Awareness Month, and Prematurity Awareness Day was, Dr. Nussbaum, do I have it correct? It was on the 17th, is that right?
Correct. So World Prematurity Day is November 17th.
As far as premature babies, and as it might have been mentioned to you, our producer, who is producing this show today, was a serious preemie when she was born. I mean, we're all kinds of concerns. We just had a friend of my son's and my daughter-in-law's who had a premature baby, and they sent me pictures, and I'm seeing that image from the newborn intensive care unit, and it just seems like you can't even count the tubes and the different things that are helping to keep that child alive. I remember back not all that long ago as we would do our telethons and radiothons at Primary Children's Hospital here in Utah, that, boy, to save a 2.5-pound preemie was a miracle. Then it was 2 pounds. So that was a miracle. And now I cannot believe when we're measuring these the weight of these very young children in ounces now. How much progress have we made, Doctor?
So we've definitely made a lot of progress keeping premature babies alive. With March of Dimes has done, has had our folic acid campaign, really encouraging moms to start prenatal vitamins and folic acid before they get pregnant so they can decrease the risk of having birth defects. Surfactant, which is a medicine that's used to help premature lungs. So we really have made a lot of progress when you look at those areas. But with regards to prematurity and preterm birth rate, the U.S. is actually facing a maternal infant health crisis right now. The preterm birth rate has increased for the fourth year in a row, and about 1 in 10 babies are born premature. So kind of now more than ever is this call to action because of this, the increasing birth rate and this crisis with mom and infant health.
Dr. Nussbaum, just so we're all on the same page here, what constitutes, what identifies a newborn baby? A premature newborn baby, I'm sorry.
Sure. So A premature baby is one that's born at before 37 weeks completed gestation.
Before 37 weeks.
Exactly. And so that's important. And while, again, we aim to have moms, you know, go full term, we always say that if a mom's pregnancy is healthy, even though, you know, when you get to the end of 37 weeks, that does constitute full term. But if her pregnancy is healthy, we really strive to have mom continue their pregnancy until they're 39, 40 weeks, just to have the best outcomes for both mom and baby.
Right. What are doctors and experts in this field thinking is behind the preterm birth rate going up, and are other countries doing better than we are?
With regards to preterm birth rates, the U.S. has probably one of the lower preterm birth rates compared to other third world countries, and so we're not doing so great. And what was the other question that you asked? I'm sorry.
And what is the cause? Why is it going up? Why are we seeing these numbers increase?
That's a great question. Probably about more than half of the causes of preterm birth are actually still unknown. So while we know that there's some things that can cause preterm birth or can increase a risk of having a preterm birth, like if you've had a prior preterm birth, moms that may have chronic health conditions like diabetes or high blood pressure, those are definitely risk factors for having a preterm birth. Other things we know that, you know, moms are having babies later on in life, and that possibly could contribute. And then we know that just when you look at the span, there's definitely a lot of inequities and just social determinants of health that kind of, you know, whether it's having access to care, having health insurance, those are all things that may contribute to potentially poorer health and possibly increased preterm birth rates. So there's unfortunately not one specific answer why. We know that there's a lot of factors that are contributing. So we're trying to figure out, you know, how to decrease preterm birth rate. And really one key component is making sure that moms are healthy.
Whenever I see things broken down into race, I always ask myself, is it a race factor or something that is maybe in the DNA, or is it general socioeconomics? What might it be? Because here in the state of Utah, if you are white, the number is 9.2 rate. If Hispanic, 10.1, Black, 10.2, American Indian, Alaska Native, 10.6, and Asian Pacific Islander, 11.7. So I'm curious about that. Is this, again, in the DNA, or is it in the circumstances?
Sure. And that's a great question. What we know is we do not believe that it is. So no, it is not something that is specific to DNA or specific to race. Rather, it's something that's more specific to, you know, we know that there's structural racism and other types of racism and maybe access to care and access to insurance based on someone's race. So it's not specific to the DNA, no. It's the care that people are getting.
This is just
one component. And so we're, again, looking at all different causes of preterm birth.
Right. As you mentioned in the beginning of our conversation, that we're on a slight upward trend that is concerning. When were we kind of at the bottom of that? When did we have the best preterm birth rate?
We had kind of one of the lower preterm birth rates about 2014, 2015, when we put out our premature birth report cards, which I can talk about. And we kind of set these goals to have, you know, really low preterm birth rates by 2020 and 2030. But unfortunately, the preterm birth rate just kind of plateaued. And then over the past 4 years or so has just been slowly creeping up. I'm talking about the preterm birth rate in the United States. And so it's kind of slowly crept up, and the preterm birth rate is now at 10%. So 1 in 10 babies are born prematurely.
Right. What is the goal? You know, the March of Dimes over my lifetime, of course, all of us, at least those who are baby boomers, such as myself, it was all about eradicating polio. And, you know, you look at the progress that has been made there is remarkable. And then birth defects and so on. And now dealing with premature birth. What is the goal? We will always have, I assume, a few here and there. But what is the goal?
Sure. Well, you're right. I mean, the goal really is to have it as low as possible. In about 2015, when we put out our premature birth report cards, we really tried to focus our goal on the Healthy People 2020 goal, which is having a preterm birth rate of 8.1% by 2020 and 5.1% by 2030. As I mentioned, the preterm birth rate has slightly increased in the past 4 years, so we're not going to hit that goal. And so really, we need to just take a step back and, you know, look at the health of moms and babies and figure out where to go next and what goals we need to set.
How are we doing overall? And I'm curious about this because sometimes when I will get a tour of a hospital and you walk through the NICU and you see what I described a little earlier, you can hardly see the baby for the equipment and everything that is going on to sustain the life. What are the odds now, and have we made a great deal of progress in the quality of the life that is being saved as well?
Sure. And I mean, I think we've definitely made progress in the quality of life. Again, babies that are born earlier are surviving, and I think that they do have a better quality of life. And as I mentioned, some of the things previously, like, you know, folic acid campaign and surfactant. And so we've definitely made improvements. Having said that, we still have a long ways to go. And, you know, premature birth takes a huge toll on families economically, socially, and emotionally. And yes, even though we've made progress, it still can be, you know, a risk factor for lifelong chronic illness for the infant.
Dr. Nussbaum, this has been most informative. I really appreciate you sharing your expertise with us. For people that have more questions, is there... do we have a website that people can go to get more information and if they need to perhaps chat with somebody?
Sure. So you could go to marchofdimes.org. And I think you mentioned this is Prematurity Awareness Month, so that's throughout the entire month of November. I'd encourage anybody to go online. You can look at the premature birth report card, or what we call now the report card, for any of the states. You can learn more about some things that we're doing in the advocacy realm to really improve the health of moms and babies. You can donate at marchofdimes.org to help life-saving research that we promote as well, and to decrease preterm birth rate. And really just share your story on social media, because that also increases awareness.
I really appreciate you joining us today. Thank you. This has been most interesting.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Amy Nussbaum with us, the Director of Maternal Child Health in Utah and in Nevada, March of Dimes. All right, let's take a brief break. I wanted to give you a heads up on Pete Ashdown, who will be joining us at 1:35. We'll spend a few minutes when we come back from this brief break. We'll catch up on some of the texts and even some of the voice messages that have been coming in regarding the crumbling or the not crumbling of the case for impeachment against President Trump. That's coming up. Stay with us. Well, I'll tell you, I asked this question right off the top of the program, and it's, do you or do you not agree with Chris Stewart, 2nd District Congressman of the great state of Utah, who says, and he said this over the weekend as he appeared on many of the Talking Head programs, that the case for impeachment of the president is crumbling now that the people, you and me, have had a chance to actually see and hear the testimony. And I'm asking, is that true? And I'll share a couple of the texts that have come in on our Utah Community Credit Union KSL text line at 57500, but we'll also play a couple of the messages that have been left on our voicemail box, which is 801-575-7668. This person said on our text message board, I have no respect for the Republicans who will defend someone with no morals and will do or say anything he wants with no repercussions. Time for term limits of 8 years and no campaign donations. All they care about is getting themselves reelected. Would they support a bishop? Maybe I could supplant that with someone in the clergy who acted like Trump. This person said, hopefully it is crumbling, that is. Anything Ms. Pelosi says or does should be dismissed. This texter said, I think that the testimonies are very compelling and that Chris Stewart is embarrassing himself. Another text, in my eyes, the case for impeachment is crumbling. While I think it's being run like a partisan circus, I nonetheless want to know what legitimate evidence there may be for an impeachable offense. But so far, I have seen none. All I've seen is political grandstanding backed up by strong opinions, but weak or no hard evidence. This person capitalizing, not crumbling. Used to have respect for veteran Chris Stewart, but he's becoming a yes-man lapdog for Trump. Not crumbling, this person said, I've been concerned from the start. His usage and direct-indirect promotion of his businesses. Didn't like Kushner's family dangle immigration papers for business deals. This person said, I believe the case for impeachment is getting stronger and stronger. And the fact that Trump doesn't want any of his people to testify tells me he has something to hide. My support for the impeachment process is getting stronger. Strengthened from the hearings, I used to highly respect Representative Stewart, but his comments at and about the hearings are absurd. Before I read a few more of the texts that are coming in, let's listen to some of the voicemails. And this person agrees that, yes, the case is crumbling.
Yeah, I think the case is crumbling. I think they keep coming up with so much that just people are not interested in, and they're going against a president that has done things for the country.
Okay, this person said, yeah, the case is building, but not to impeachment.
Doug, I believe the case is building, not necessarily towards impeachment, but his unbelievable incompetence and self-service. And while there may be a very solid case for impeachment, I also feel that the Congress is using it as an excuse not to get anything else accomplished.
That's a real concern. On any given day, is the country being well served by the 116th Congress? I can't remember the number, but our Congress right here and right now. And, you know, I think some garden variety day in, day out, you know, things are happening. But some of the really big, important things, I think Congress has virtually abdicated its responsibilities. You look at the immigration question. We shouldn't still be here with the insurance and making sure that Americans can buy affordable health insurance. We shouldn't be where we are right now. There are so many other things, too. There are land issues, you name it. It just goes on and on, honestly. And these are things that we've been talking about, arguing about, wrangling about for years. And here's one thing that Mitt Romney said this not long ago. He said it on my Sunday morning TV show. He said, I'm beginning to wonder if anybody really wants to solve, and he mentioned the immigration problem in particular, and I think you could fill in the blank here. Does anybody really want to solve this? Or are they just using it as a wedge issue? Are they using that to promote fundraising, to reelect themselves, to retain their party's power, to retain the presidency? And I think, sadly, there's some truth to that. I really ask myself sometimes, where is the desire to really get in and get this thing done? This person said, crumbling. It's interesting with this administration when they tell you what's going on. It always seems to be the opposite of what the truth is. This person just said, crumbling. This person said, I'm against Trump, and I was against impeachment. After hearing and reading about what he and his associates have done, I'm for impeachment, and I wish I wasn't. And boy, I can't read this one without bleeps all over the place, but it's just blank impeach him already. Stewart is a hack, said the next texter. Trump has ignored subpoenas, which is criminal and impeachable. My true feelings. Boy, it just goes on and on. We've had a real outpouring, and we'll play a few more voice messages for you, and we'll have a couple of little places we can insert those in the remaining part of the program. But Pete Ashdown will be joining us next, and we'll talk about saving the Utah Theater in downtown Salt Lake City.
The afternoon insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Okay, I'm going to get a little misty and nostalgic here for just a moment. When I think of the old Utah Theater, Boy, I have some memories there. The very first memory I have of going to the Utah Theater, and there may have been some before this, but where I clearly remember, it was the Sound of Music, going with my mom and my grandparents. I believe my cousins also went that night. And I remember just being in awe of that theater. It was just breathtaking, gorgeous. And the one thing that anybody who has ever been in the Utah Theater recalls is the beautiful glass ceiling. And I don't know, it's been called a Tiffany glass ceiling, but I don't know if it's actually Tiffany glass or not. But, and it goes on. I remember seeing Towering Inferno or Earthquake or one of those movies there. I remember seeing The Great Gatsby there. And the last thing that I can recall seeing at the old Utah Theater in downtown Salt Lake City, it's on Main Street on the west side of the street. The last thing that I remember seeing there was a children's theater production of The Secret Garden. Now, by then, they had cut that theater in half. So there was an upstairs and a downstairs. The children's theater was upstairs. And Dee and I took all of our kids to see The Secret Garden there. And and then to get even a little more inside baseball, a little more misty with you for a moment, I never worked at call radio, but that's where, back when I started in radio and some of the really historic broadcasts for call radio, at that time 910 call radio, it was right there on Main Street. I can remember the call radio microphone man that used to sit right on the top of the building. And it's not, at least on the Main Street front, it wasn't particularly high, and the call radio studios were right there. And the microphone man, it's a really historic spot, a really historic building. And there has been so much talk about saving this building over the years that honestly, I'd kind of forgotten where we were until recently. We heard rumblings that Salt Lake City, under Mayor Biskupski, was thinking of just throwing in the towel and selling this thing. And then on top of it would be this great big high-rise condo building. So when I saw that Pete Ashdown is involved with the Save the Utah Theater organization, I thought, you know, Pete and I have talked about everything known to mankind over the years, but I don't recall ever talking about historical preservation or repurposing or saving a theater, and I thought this would be a good day to do it. Pete, welcome to the program.
Howdy, Doug. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm assuming, like me, Pete, you have some amazing memories of things at the old Utah Theater.
Well, the Sound of Music is kind of legendary, but that was actually before my time. The theater was split into the two theaters, the two movie theaters in 1968. I did see some movies there in the 80s, and you know, certainly the terracotta and the surroundings were impressive. But I have memories of the Center Theater, seeing Star Wars there, and
right,
Indiana Jones, and of course the Villa Theater, which is now a rug gallery. I have very fond memories of being in the large audiences of over 1,000 people and watching great films. One of the best memories of that is the 70mm theater at the Regency when they brought Lawrence of Arabia to town in a re-release, and I went and saw that and was just utterly blown away by the quality and the communal feeling of seeing a movie theater filled with people from Salt Lake City watching a great film.
That's right. Now when you have 400, 500, maybe in a really big theater, 600. I remember Trolley Corners used to have about 800 seats. There's a whole generation that has never had that experience of sitting with 1,000 other people in the dark watching whatever the big movie of the day or the era. And as you mentioned, one of the reasons that The Sound of Music was absolutely legendary, it showed for years, over a year there. It was like the Villa Theater. I thought the Villa Theater, when I was a little kid, had been built to show South Pacific. It was always there, you know, and in kid years, you know, a year, that's like, you know, 25% of your life, and you think that it was just built for that purpose. What is it that has motivated you, Pete, with all of the things you're involved in, X-Mission, everything else, politics? We've talked about so many things over the years, high tech and, you know, cybersecurity. Why is this getting your interest?
Well, I have always been a champion for historic preservation. I think that if we don't preserve our past, our future is somewhat pointless. I have served as the chair of Preservation Utah, formerly Historic, the Utah Heritage Foundation. And I believe preserving the culture and history of a city is what makes a city great. That's why we go to places like Paris and London and look at the buildings that are hundreds of years old. It's not to see the newest and the latest. And certainly taking out Utah Theater and putting a high-rise condo there, nobody's going to come see that.
Yeah.
You mentioned about how the younger generations of today haven't really had that experience. Well, maybe they have because other cities have these grand theaters. Los Angeles has a number of grand theaters. Denver has grand theaters. I was just in Denver a month ago, and I saw a show in a grand old theater there that would have not fit anywhere else. So I've been surprised to see how many young people have stepped forward and said, we want to save this theater as well and have campaigned for it as well. Some of them were born after the Utah Theater closed its doors for the final time. So I think that there's a broad wealth of experience across generations that love the idea of a grand movie theater, and we don't have one in Salt Lake, and the Utah Theater is literally the last grand movie theater standing.
You know, it is magical when you can preserve something and repurpose it. It's a term that's used often, and I think of some of the extraordinary buildings that I've just been in recently. We went to Europe for the first time. We had been in London and very briefly in Paris, but I'd never taken some of those legendary trips where you get to see some of the really historic buildings. You know, here, if we talk about something that's 100, 150 years old, I mean, wow. Over there, you talk about things that were, you know, built 1,000 years ago, and they're still vibrant in the community. They are still useful. They've been repurposed in the community and sometimes just flat preserved because of their magnificence. And I was in San Francisco just a little while ago with Dee, and you look at the trolley building there that is now, it's still absolutely functions. That's where all the cables go and come from and go to. But yet it's a museum as well. I think of the potential of the Utah Theater, and it's almost breathtaking what could happen there. Over the Capitol Theater, we could have torn that down. And I remember going to see the unsinkable Molly Brown there. I'd interviewed Debbie Reynolds the day before, and we were there for the performance the next night, I believe. And I remember after everything was said and done, she came out to take a bow and a little encore applause. And I remember, speaking of getting misty, Debbie Reynolds came out and stood on the front of that stage, looked around the theater, and she looked at the audience, all of us right in the eye at the same time, and she said, "Thank you for saving this grand old gal." I'll never forget that. And she was referring to the theater. And when we come back, could we talk about what the process is going to be here and what are the possibilities and what are some of the pluses and maybe even some of the liabilities? Can we do that, Pete?
I'd be happy to.
All right. When we come back, saving the Utah Theater. It'll be the topic of conversation. Plus, I'd love to hear from you. You know, we've asked for a lot of response from you today, and boy, we have got it on numerous topics, primarily the impeachment. But hey, let's talk about something maybe a little more elegant and a little more positive. Let's talk about, should we save the Utah Theater? So good to have you along today. We're getting some texts in as we talk about the old Utah Theater and what should its future be. This person says just simply, "Save the Utah Theater!" Exclamation point. This person said, "I was very fortunate to perform with the Children's Theater in the Utah Theater, the beautiful marble hallway. It was always underneath that old crappy movie theater carpeting. That marble hallway was amazing." And hello to Pete from Duane. This person said, "Utah Theater, Sound of Music with my grandmother and grandfather also, or with my mother and grandmother also." You know, Pete, there's a lot of nostalgia, but sometimes nostalgia, unless it really can be done, repurposed, and become useful, is wishful thinking or an albatross. What do we do, or what is in the proposal that can make this a true gathering place for Utah and especially our capital city? And a lot of people say, hey, didn't the Eccles Theater kind of take care of this?
Well, it's funny you say proposal, because that's my biggest criticism of how the mayor and the city has handled this, is for the past 4 years, they have exclusively negotiated with the LaSalle restaurants on this property. It has not been put out for proposals. They have summary, you know, LaSalle walked in 2015 and said that they were going to save the theater. They were going to turn it into a dinner theater. And when they decided they couldn't do that, then the city negotiated with them and neighboring Heinz Properties to come up with a different solution. And the solution that they have is to tear it down. I've talked to other developers in town. I've talked to philanthropists who have an interest, and the city hasn't. The city has not put this out to proposals. The city has not made this a public process. They simply negotiated with one and two property owners and came up with a summary that it couldn't be saved. I don't believe that's in the best public interest. The city bought this theater with the intent of restoring it. The RDA spent a ridiculous amount of money on the Eccles Theater, which isn't a movie theater. It's a stage, and it brings great Broadway shows to Salt Lake City, and I don't discredit that, but they didn't make that a public process either, because I don't think the voters would have approved it. It was $180 million for the Eccles Theater. I'm glad we've got it. We've got it now, and let's utilize it and enjoy it. But the Utah Theater is also something we can utilize and enjoy, and the public should have a say, and other developers should have a say on it too.
Is the $60 million an accurate number, do you believe, Pete, in what it would take to seismically work on that building and restore it?
I question that primarily because Alexander Pantages built these theaters all across the country. And there are two theaters, one in Minneapolis and one in Tacoma, that are sister theaters to the Utah Theater in that they're identical on the inside. Tacoma had a usable theater, but they decided to do some restoration work on it and seismically reinforce it. It cost them $25 million to do that last year. And when Minneapolis decided to restore their theater, it cost them $8 million in 2003. I believe I've been a board member for the Utah Film Center, which paid for a lot of the studies on this theater, and the restorations that they showed were closer to $30 million. So I question the number, but that's something we should reopen and investigate again so we can get an accurate number, because this hasn't been done for almost a decade.
Yeah. Pete, what is the condition of the building? I've worried about that. I described it the way I remembered it, and maybe you could give me more information. It was always described as a Tiffany ceiling, but I think that's a generic term. It's like an elevator, you know, regardless of who built it. But
it is a Tiffany glass ceiling. And thankfully, the prior property owner recognized the value of that and at least restored the roof over that ceiling. So that is very much intact. What happened in 1969 when they extended the balcony to the stage to make a second theater caused the most damage, in that they cut away the boxes, they cut away a lot of the terracotta, and that is where most of the damage is. And I don't doubt there's water damage. I mean, it has been neglected for almost three decades. There's probably water damage that needs to be repaired, and there's terracotta that needs to be replaced. But I'm encouraged by the fact that we have blueprints from two other theaters that we can use to do this. And I talked to some of the people involved with those restorations, and they're excited and interested in helping us do it. So I think it's possible. We just have to have the will to do it, and the city hasn't expressed that will. And in fact, the mayor shot down the opportunity for a ballot vote to get a bond to do this, because she didn't think there was a will to do it. And my opinion is, well, that's what a ballot is for. If the voters didn't want to do it, and there's no developer that's willing to do it, then yeah, I guess it's doomed. But the city has made that judgment without really exploring all the opportunities.
Boy, we're getting quite a few texts and people getting really reminiscent about even the little theater that used to be in their neighborhood. This person said the lack of historic preservation and inability to follow through the public process to restore the Utah Theater shows the mayor and city council need to be thrown out. This person said, I even miss the Queen Theater in Bountiful. It was torn down for the building of another business. I think people do, you know, have reminiscences. I can remember talking with Greg Miller years ago about the Villa Theater. And at that time, Dr. Abib, I can't remember. Anyway, he had purchased it and was doing some restorative work and at least kept the sign and a few things, which I applaud him for. But it ain't a movie theater anymore. And that was a huge loss for, I think, the city, the area, and for film buffs everywhere. And the idea of thinking that maybe the Utah Theater could be brought back to life. Are there any major players? Because Greg, you know, expressed some regret that maybe the Larry H. Miller Group didn't go in and buy the villa and maybe even add on to it and add some parking and keep the original auditorium pretty much the way it was. Any major hitters like that talking about getting involved?
I wish I could express some of the names, but in spite of the interest they have expressed to me, they haven't come forward yet. So I think it's really a matter of at least one major player coming forward and saying, I would help with this project, and the rest will follow behind. And I also think it's not just the city responsibility. I think that this, you know, especially when we have a festival, the best film festival in the country, Sundance, that this is a statewide responsibility, that we have to recognize that Salt Lake is a center for film exhibition and production in the Western United States, and we should capitalize that. I've heard numbers that Sundance brings upwards of $180 million in tourist revenue every year to Utah, and I think that it's not just the city's responsibility, it's the county, it's the state, and possibly the federal government, in addition to willing donors to turn this theater around. But again, the city's not exploring that. They need to open this process and try it.
Can you imagine the optics of opening the Sundance, you know, or at least having major things at the Utah Theater and how that would look to the rest of the world? I mean, we think about the Chinese Theater down in Los Angeles for all of the spectacular openings. And, oh, my goodness, Pete, I've just got a second. How can people get involved? What should they do?
We have a website up at SaveTheUtahTheater.org. That links to our Facebook and Twitter page as well as a petition. But most importantly, call the city council and let them know that you want this process opened up.
Pete, as always, I appreciate the conversation. Always great to chat with you.
You too, Doug. Thank you so much.
Pete Ashdown with us here at KSL News Radio. It is 2 o'clock. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about our great teachers and educators. And this is a time we can appreciate what they are doing during American Educators Week.
Insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Well, thanks to everybody who have been contributing, either with voicemails or also texts. And most of the texts have been regarding the question that I asked at the beginning of the program. Is support, and this is Congressman Chris Stewart, who made this claim over the weekend with a lot of talking heads on TV. His claim is that the public support for the impeachment process or the impeachment of President Donald Trump is crumbling now that we are actually seeing the sausages being made. Is that the point? I don't think it's been quite 50-50. A lot of our texters, at least, on the Utah Community Credit Union KSL text line have been saying, crumbling? Are you kidding me? This is making me more and more angry and more leaning toward impeachment. But a few people have said, no, it is crumbling. So we'll share some more of those coming up. But also on whether or not we should save the old Utah Theater, this person, I thought it was interesting, this person has never been in the theater. They say, the Utah Theater is the last historic film palace in Salt Lake City and must be saved. I've never been inside, and I feel very strongly about this. For those who have never been inside, if you want to Google the Utah Theater and look at what is or was inside at one point, I'll tell you, even as a little kid, even before they cut the thing in half, extended the stage out, as Pete alluded to, took out some of the old, you know, glorious boxes and all of the terracotta and so on. Even as a little kid, I can remember just going, holy cow. Yeah, and you'd look up and, you know, practically crane your neck looking at what Pete confirmed is a Tiffany glass ceiling in there. It's really quite remarkable. So I'll share some more of the texts as they come in. It's American Education Week. And what exactly does that mean? And what is happening? Well, today is kickoff day. Tuesday is Parents Day. Wednesday, Education Support Professionals Day. Thursday is Educator for a Day. And Friday, November 22nd, Substitute Educators Day. Well, I thought we'd go right to the mountaintop here, and we'd talk with the president of the Utah Education Association, Heidi Matthews, who is on the phone line with us. Heidi, welcome. Thank you for taking time.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Many of us who not only love and appreciate the teachers we had or the teachers that our children and now even grandchildren have had, many of us just have looked for opportunities of how to kind of give back to our educators. As you know, Heidi, I come from a family of educators. I'm the only one that went astray and got into the dubious broadcasting business.
You know, still do a fair bit of educating.
Well, I'll tell you, I my mother and on my wife's side especially, they were all teachers. And my wife still works in education today, as you know. And
yes.
For our teachers, we've talked so much. We've had a lot of meetings lately that you and I have even participated in as to what it will take. I'm not going to say would take, but will take to make teaching the profession that we want it to be for those who are employed in it, those who want the results from it, to keep it a highly respected profession, which it always is and always has been and should be. But sometimes when you look at the remuneration, when you look at the compensation, sadly we have too few people going into the profession, and those that do seem to, after about 5 years, they're just going, you know, I need to be able to take care of my family.
Mm-hmm.
Bring us up to speed on where we stand right now and what educators are saying.
Well, I think I love all the points that you were bringing up. You know, American Education Week came about with first being discussed in 100 years ago, following World War I, and the fact that our veterans were coming back, and many of them were illiterate and in poor health, and the National Education Association, together with the American Legion, came together to try to figure out how can we bolster public education in our communities. And this was the genesis for the idea of American Education Week. I think it's important to note that the American Education Week celebrates all of the educators who come together in our schools, from our teachers to our support professionals to the important foundations of our parents to the substitute teachers who come in when we are not able to, you know, be in our classrooms, and how we all come together to ensure that every child receives a quality education. And as you pointed out, there are a lot of conversations going on right now, and a lot of pressures that are being put on educators, on teachers, and more than ever, we really need the support of our communities, reminding us of the value that we have in our communities and in our world. You know, I have been personally bolstered so many times when I visit with former students. Just a couple weeks ago, I had coffee with a student I had when I taught at Copper Hills High School in West Jordan, Danielle. And Danielle now has a son who is the same age as she was when she was in my class. And to be able to see her just grow into this fabulous adult with hopes and dreams for her son, and a reflection. She reflects back on my class as being an important part of her education, and that I had an influence on her, and who has she has become. And that's what I would encourage your listeners today to do, is to reach out to those people who have made a difference in your life, in your schooling, and don't wait, because right now our teachers are they are feeling so overburdened and sometimes demoralized to the point where they're walking out the door rather than facing another day, not being able to do the job that they know that they need to do for our students. So, you know, let's celebrate them, reach out to them, remind them of their impact. And then as a society, we need to figure out how we are going to fund plans that we know will make a difference in making teaching and education sustainable careers for the adults that go into our classrooms. We must provide compensation so that our teachers can make this a sustainable living for their own families, that they don't have to have second and third jobs in order to do that. And that'll take a while. We didn't get here overnight. We need to be investing in those things that really make a difference for our students, such as class sizes where our students can be known, support professionals who can tend to the mental and emotional health of our students to get them ready to learn. And of course, really paying attention to those students who are coming to our schools with greater needs that need to be met before they are able to learn. And in the short term, we've got to make sure that this tax restructure ensures ongoing and significant investments into our education system to be able to grow what we are able to offer for our students and spark their curiosity and motivation.
So well said. So many things that we need to do and make this the profession that people aspire to. And you may never end up making a gazillion dollars being a teacher, but you ought to be able to make your mortgage payment. You ought to be able to make a car payment. You ought to be able to provide for your children. And you ought not to be forced to have three or four different jobs. And that's one thing that drives me nuts with so many of the most important professions in our community that we all rely on each and every day, whether it's law enforcement, whether it's fire protection, whether it's our teachers, whether it's, you know, first responders of any kind. There are so many. And people ought to be able to aspire to those jobs, be able to take care of their families. And you know what? I don't want a cop on the beat who just worked all night on a second job so he or she could feed their family. I don't want a teacher who's walking into the classroom in the morning with my grandson just born here before too long. I don't want a teacher who all of a sudden had to work 14 or 15 hours and is bleary-eyed because he or she needed to do that in order to take care of their family. I don't know where we let this priority slip so far, Heidi.
I just amen to all of that, and we'll be having a meeting about that on November 25th. So invite you to join that tax restructure conversation. But getting back to this awesome week of celebrating our educators, I think every time we talk about making investments in education or foregoing a tax cut so that we know that those funds that are designated for education actually make it to our classrooms, we need to personalize it. We need to bring it down to our own experiences being in school and having that educator support personnel who retrieved your essay from the server after it fell off your computer, or, you know, to the custodian who greeted you every day, or your English teacher who inspired your love of reading and writing, or your library media teacher, my favorite, who helped you to recognize bias in our media and understand credible sources, and all of these things that we benefit from as a society and in our world and individually is so rooted in how we take care of our students, and we take care of our students by making the adults in the schools be able to have sustainable careers in those schools. So contact your former teachers who made such a big or former educators, I should say, who made that impression in your life, who is still with you, and then personalize it when you vote and when you support policies, because these policies directly impact our classrooms.
Heidi, I so appreciate you joining us. There is so much more that we should and will talk about. It may be on the Sunday morning TV show because I won't be doing this much longer, but I so appreciate your insights. I appreciate all of the hard work, and boy, when I think back on my life, and I think of the, first of all, I had some great, great teachers overall, generally, but I had a few that were just golden, and I owe so much of the good things that have happened in my life. You know, whenever you take things outside of family, the first people you usually acknowledge are either people within your ecclesiastical circle or your teachers, and I can't thank them enough, and Heidi, I thank you for joining us today.
And I'm sure your educator family is very proud of the work that you do, too.
So, some days I wonder, I look at what they do, I look at their hard work, I look at their long hours, and honestly, sometimes I'm just in awe. Heidi, thank you again.
It's the best career I could ever imagine, though.
Yep. Heidi Matthews with us. Thank you.
Thank you for celebrating American Education Week.
The president of the Utah Education Association with us. Let's go ahead and take a break. When we come back, we'll share some of the texts. We'll share some of the voicemails that have been coming in on a myriad of topics, primarily, of course, on the impeachment process, prompted by the question that I asked at the beginning of the program, and when Congressman Stewart over the weekend said, well, now that the public is seeing this process, I feel the support is crumbling for impeachment. Is it? We'll talk about it. I'm not sure if it's a record number or not for at least the time period that I've been filling in anticipation of Lee Lonsberry coming to Utah, back to Utah to do this show. He's been working in Congressman Bishop's communications department for some time now, but he'll be back in the beginning of December. The date, not exactly sure, but not too far away, 3 weeks or so around the corner. But in the time that I've been keeping the chair warm, we've just had a spectacular outpouring of text messages today, and the majority of them are regarding the impeachment and reacting to Congressman Stewart saying now that the public is seeing this process with these open meetings on the impeachment, the hearings, that the support for impeachment is crumbling. Maybe Congressman Stewart ought to read some of the texts and some of the messages that are coming in, and I'm sure many from his congressional district here in the state of Utah. I've known Chris for years. I like Chris. He's a friend of mine, and I mean that. He is a friend of mine. But, boy, sometimes I wonder what happens when you get back to Washington if the blinders just get so tight that your peripheral vision and your kind of judgment on what the pulse of the folks are out there sometimes. Let me share some of the text messages that are coming in before we take a break at the bottom of the hour. And when we do come back from our news at the bottom of the hour, Ron Gibson will join us, president of the Utah Farm Bureau Federation. And their convention is coming up. Okay, now, before you nod off here, if you're not a farmer, of course, if you're in agriculture, you're just wagging your tail over this. But the fact is, what they are going to be talking about at the Farm Bureau Convention is going to affect us all. And I thought it was interesting because there are some hot topics that are there. I mean, the new taxation system, you heard Heidi Matthews mention that too. This is affecting everybody, how the new tax structure in the state of Utah will shake out. They're also going to talk about suicide, I thought was very interesting. I know where my wife's from, back in Missouri. There's been a real issue about that in the rural areas, on the farms. back in Missouri, and same here in the state of Utah. And then also this one with some of the new medical marijuana laws, some of the things that are happening in our state and elsewhere. What about that? I mean, all of a sudden it's kind of interesting to think of marijuana as a cash crop for which you won't be arrested. So we'll talk about all that coming up. But now to share just a couple of the texts. This person said, Doug, when I was a kid and in elementary school, I remember I used to go to the Utah Theater and watch movies there every weekend. It was amazing. It was an amazing place back then. I still remember the grand old place and agree that it should go on. And we should vote to save the Utah Theater. It is a beautiful theater. This person said, I support the impeachment even more, responding to Chris Stewart. Representative Stewart has his GOP glasses on. Yes, save the theater, too. I've been inside. It is incredible. And this person said, the Utah Theater is the last historic film palace in Salt Lake, and save it. All right, we're at the bottom of the hour. Let's take a break, and when we do come back, what is on the docket for the Utah Farm Bureau Federation and their convention that is now just around the corner? That should be an interesting conversation. I look forward to talking about that next.
Insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Maybe it's because of my wife's family's background in agriculture. Of course, that's back in Missouri. And then the close relationship I've had with people who are in the business of agriculture here in the state of Utah, that when I saw this story come across today, Utah farmers and ranchers talking industrial hemp, suicide prevention, and other issues at the 2019 Utah Farm Bureau Convention, for some reason it got my attention. First of all, so many of the things we've talked about, I mean, suicide preventions, other things, tax reform, all included. And I thought, you know what, let's call the president of the Utah Farm Bureau Federation. And Ron Gibson is on the line with us. And Ron, welcome, and thank you for taking time to join us.
Thanks, Doug. It's an honor to be on the show today.
This is just right up our alley in the state of Utah lately, and I wanted to talk about some of these things. I can't tell you how much of a focus we've had here at KSL and with our partners and colleagues and friends at the Deseret News on suicide prevention. We've talked so much about medicinal marijuana and so on, even hemp, and we've also talked to a great length about what the new tax system, however it shakes out, and that's still to be seen, of course, how that will affect everybody. And Ron, maybe you could kind of put us on a solid foundation. I remember years ago I was talking with Leonard Blackham, and who, of course, is engaged in agriculture, was over agriculture within the governor's office, and then one of our state senators. And he and I used to talk a lot about agriculture. And at the time, I seem to recall he said that it was about 13 or 14% of Utah's economy. Is that number still accurate?
It's actually about 17% of Utah's economy today. And the industry is very, very important to the economy in the state of Utah. And not only just for the economic perspective, but there's a cultural aspect of a healthy agricultural industry that to me, you can't put a dollar value on. It's irreplaceable.
I remember Leonard used to say, and we'd talk about oil shortages. Things have changed, fortunately, but we were talking about the high price of gas and things like that. And he said, boy, if you think it's tough to have to rely on foreign entities for your oil and energy, imagine how it would be if you were relying on foreign entities for your agriculture products and your food. And I've never, ever forgotten that. How is Utah's agriculture industries, how are the industries doing overall right now?
We are in a four-year slump right now. And the all of this trade stuff has been extremely challenging for us. And for whatever reason, all of our markets in ag are really are really down, and it's been a tough time for farmers and ranchers, and it looks like there's a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. We hope that we can get some of these things resolved and breathe some life back into that. But in the state of Utah, what happens is in the northern part of the state, where we have a lot of growth, if the farmers can't be profitable and stay in business, then their land goes to development.
Yeah.
And that's something that is really concerning to us.
It's been quite a while now, but I was asked to speak to the Santa Quinn Chamber of Commerce. And, you know, since the Brigham area corridor of fruit growing has diminished a bit, it became kind of the southern end of Utah Lake and Santa Quinn and Goshen and Alberta and that area that had picked up the slack. But I can remember the mayor, and again, this has been about a decade or so ago, that I gave that speech, and the mayor came up and said, you know, Doug, it used to be that if somebody had a bad year, they toughed it out. If they had a second bad year, everybody would get together, would survive a little longer. Third bad year, it started getting really serious in the fourth or fifth bad year. You mentioned we're in a four-year slump. He said, but now what happens is one bad year, and a lot of these people just sell to developers. It's becoming a real issue, even down in the southern part of Utah County.
Well, you know, you make a really good point, and you can't blame the producer for feeling that way. I mean, what's happened is a lot of the smaller farms have gone out of business, and a lot of the bigger farms are still family farms, but they've just grown. And when we talk about a bad year, I mean, you can really erode your equity. And when you work through your equity, that's one thing. When you work through your dad's equity, that starts to get complexing. And when you work through grandpa's equity, you start to really get concerned. And that's why some of our producers are looking at that. You know, it all depends on the stage of life that they're in and how long, what the future is. But boy, you can't blame a guy for getting out of the business if he's losing hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. You know?
Well, boy, no kidding, and especially when you figure that person, if they have a sizable orchard or a sizable little even family farm, it can be worth millions of dollars. And if you watch it, as you mentioned, eroding away and you're getting deeper and deeper in debt, there would be a motivation that, hey, you get out while the getting's good and I can still walk away with enough money maybe to take care of my family for a considerable amount of time. Let's talk about some of these particular issues that are going to be addressed here at the end of the week. Tell me what industrial hemp is. You know, I immediately, when I see the word hemp, I think of marijuana. I think of marijuana-type products, but I know hemp is a real agriculture product as well for making ropes and many other things. When you discuss hemp at the upcoming convention, what are you going to be talking about?
Well, Hemp was put into the 2018 Farm Bill, and so it's legalized throughout the United States now. And in, I think, all of the states, except for three, it's legalized in. And what hemp is there's two components to that. There's the oil,
CBD or whatever,
for healing products and a lot of the cosmetic products that a lot of that oil has been coming in from outside of the United States now. We've been importing that for a lot of the cosmetic products that are there. And then the other aspect of that is the fiber products that come from the plant itself. And that is an industry that we believe will pick up the slack for a timber industry that is struggling. I mean, we feel like that's something that really has a future. And the fiber part of that, they're using it to make cars. It's lightweight, you know, door paneling for vehicles, all kinds of different clothing, building materials. I mean, that is an industry that if I was to look down the road 10 or 15 years, industrial hemp and the fibrous part of that plant is going to be a huge part of our economy.
Wow. Is there a place in the state that you are looking forward to seeing that burgeoning and growing in that area?
All over the state. In fact, this is the first year that I I know that it was grown in the state, but we had farmers pretty well from Cache County to the bottom of the state dabble in it a little bit this year.
Mm-hmm.
And what we need to do is we need to develop processing capability for the fiber. And we feel like that's a true opportunity. When you kind of look at the national scene, a lot of the Midwest has, you know, basically they grow corn and soybeans and they alternate. And this is like an opportunity to have a third crop, so corn, soybeans, and hemp. So it's an opportunity to step that up and really give rural America a boost.
Interesting.
And the agricultural industry across the country.
When a farmer steps into that arena, are they burdening themselves with all kinds of regulation and jumping through hoops and scrutiny?
A little bit, you know. I mean, we talked about doing a little bit this year. We didn't actually do it, but we talked about it a little bit. And, you know, the first concern that you have is, you know, my wife was like, are we growing marijuana, you know? And my dad was like, he's 83. Like, what are you talking about? And,
Yeah. You
know, you talk about it with some of your neighbors, and they're like, whoa, what are you guys doing? And, you know, first of all, it's just education. I mean, that's not what it is. It's not marijuana at all and has nothing to do with that. And it really can be a real opportunity for our industry and for our state, mm-hmm. I believe. But there is definitely an education level that needs to happen.
Is there an opportunity for medicinal marijuana growth? And is that happening as well?
There absolutely is an opportunity. And now that is very regulated. That's a lot more difficult to get into, and a lot more limited with how that works. The Department of Agriculture is really watching over that and trying to make it right. And you know, I support medicinal marijuana. I think that's a good thing for many people. It helps with the opioid crisis and all that kind of stuff. I just feel like we have to be really careful in our state that we don't let it get into something where it turns into a recreational issue and we have some of the same messes that we have on the West Coast and in Colorado.
Right. Let's quickly talk about two of the other issues that got my attention, and you obviously will be talking about much, much more. But how serious are farmers taking the realignment of our taxes, especially when it comes to sales tax and so on here in the state of Utah? How could it most affect positively or negatively agriculture?
Well, it could actually, if this tax bill isn't done right, it could put the final nail into agriculture, you know, and it'd be really bad. What we have to understand is that Utah lawmakers for years and for decades have made the wise choice not to tax inputs to production. It's good tax policy, and it's enabled Utah to be a consistent, strong economic state. So going forward, we need to make sure that the tax reform bill adheres to this policy. And what I mean by that is we don't want to have a pyramided tax structure. So I have a dairy farm, for example, and if I have to pay sales tax on the corn and the soybeans that come into my farm to make that milk, that would kill us.
Yeah.
Where that sales tax should be paid is when that final product is sold at the grocery store. When my milk is sold at the store, then we pay the tax on that, and that's how we should be collecting our sales tax. Mm-hmm. We in agriculture are no different than any manufacturing facility. A car making, you know, a factory that makes cars shouldn't pay sales tax on the steel that comes in. They should pay sales tax on the car when it's sold. And if we pay that multiple times, then I don't believe that's a true sales tax.
Right. Ron, maybe I could ask you a final quick question. Suicide prevention is such a hot topic in the state of Utah. Our numbers, honestly, are a little, they're a lot startling. And even compared to the nation, there is an anomaly here. How is this affecting those who are on our farms and our dairies and in our agriculture business?
Well, the farms, as I told you, our industry is kind of, it's in a four-year slump right now. And I'll just speak for myself. My farm is a is a sixth-generation farm, and we have been in business on the same land, same family, since 1869.
Wow.
So I have a tremendous level of stewardship and responsibility placed upon me, and have very little to do with the price that I'm being paid for my crops. Yeah. And so it's a challenge. And farmers around the country and even in our state and in our communities feel that stewardship. And they feel like if they fail in agriculture, they're not only letting themselves down, but they're letting their previous generations down. And it is a burden that I see in the eyes of our producers throughout the state, and I feel myself that is unreal. And that's why it's such a big deal. That's why the suicide prevention is such a big deal to agricultural producers. And what we need to do is help find ways for agriculture to be successful in the state. And hemp is one thing, but there are a myriad of other things that we can do to help drive economic dollars. If we want agriculture to be successful, the producers have to be able to turn a profit.
Yep.
And if they can turn a profit, their farms are not for sale. No farmer that is making money wants to sell his farm. That's what they want to do. It's like it's a weird thing. It's bred into us, and that's what we want to do.
Ron, I really appreciate you joining us. I understand exactly what you're saying. I don't have the firsthand experience, but through my wife and that side of the family, they have a centennial family farm. I've been in the family for well over now 100 years back there in Grundy County, Missouri. And I know what you're talking about. I've seen it through my wife's eyes and through her family's eyes. Ron, I wish you the best with your convention. Thank you for the insights you've given us today.
Thanks, Doug. Have a good day.
You too. Ron Gibson with us here at KSL News Radio. And when I saw these topics, I thought, wow, that is really interesting. These things that are affecting us all, and it's affecting our agricultural community, which, according to Ron, is 17% of our economy. In the few moments we'll have left on the other side of this break, I want to share some of the final texts that have come in, and we'll give you a little heads up as to what we'll be delving into tomorrow, too, all here at KSL. Well, this has been a slammed show today. We've been all over the place. I do want to share a couple of the voicemails that were left for us. And one of our voicemailers said that, well, she thought it was pretty fair.
I believe the impeachment process is fair. We saw this play out with Nixon and Bill Clinton. And in this case, I think there's far more evidence to impeach than ever before, period. And I also don't believe anyone is above the law, including the president, despite what he says.
And let's just share another comment that came in.
When you ask whether the impeachment inquiry is crumbling, that implies that there was ever something there to crumble. And I would suggest that there has never been anything there. I think the whole impeachment inquiry is an impeachment inquiry looking for a crime, as evidenced by the fact that at every turn, when they get stumped, they come up with something new and different. It was collusion. It was obstruction. It was quid pro quo. Now it's bribery? Oh, come on. Get over it. Stop it. Just grow up.
Let's take another comment that just came in.
Yeah, speaking of President Trump, I've never seen anybody in my lifetime with so much hate, venom, and lies that comes out of a person's mouth. And then here today I heard that he's willing to do away with the vaping ban in order to get votes in certain states. This guy's a disgrace to America. Impeaching.
Well, you can hear that the opinions are all over the place on this one. This person said, I think this impeached Trump has become a new religion, all on faith that someone high up is speaking the truth, but with no facts to back it up. This person said, the case for impeachment is not crumbling. Stewart is so fallible and so Republican brainwashed, he has to tell the public anything he can that's pro-Trump. It's so sad that we have a leader who is such a liar, racist, womanizer, and so dehumanizing to anyone who disagrees with anything he wants. He's such a crybaby. He is so sad. This person said President Trump has not behaved ethically. He believes he is above the law and accountability doesn't apply to him. Boy, it goes on and on. We'll see you back here tomorrow at 12:30.